Tonight I'm going to talk about attachment to being right. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with simply being right. You know, it's fine to be right about things. But when it becomes an attachment, when there's this sort of life and death, you know, I need to be right, you know, that sort of thing. And it may be that there's some evolutionary basis for attaching so much importance to it. You know, I mean, in the natural world, it can be important sometimes to be right about, you know, these berries are edible. These berries are poisonous, you know, and if you got that messed up, you know, you won't be around very long, you know. So, you know, there may have been instances in which there were life and death consequences to being right and wrong. And in some sense, in the modern world, there is also, but it's about very trivial stuff. You know, for example, a green traffic light means go. A red traffic light means stop. If you were to get those two mixed up, it would be a big problem, you know. But nobody gets those mixed up, you know. That's not controversial at all, you know. Or the people who do have trouble keeping track of that, they're probably having trouble keeping track of so many other things that they're locked away somewhere, you know. And so it's funny because sometimes people attach this almost life and death importance to being right or wrong. You know, and right and wrong about all kinds of abstract things. It might be political, philosophical. You know, which sports team is the best, which, you know, movie or song or whatever is the best. You know, people can get very emotional about these sorts of things, even spiritual topics. You know, people can get, you know, incredibly fixated on, you know, this view or this understanding or that understanding of Buddhism is right, you know, that sort of thing. And it's tricky because if the fight or flight system is activated, that actually exacerbates the problem. See, if the fight or flight system, also the stress system, technically it's the sympathetic nervous system. When the sympathetic nervous system is aroused, it makes thinking very simplistic, very black and white, very simple. When we're in a high state of sympathetic arousal, we lose all appreciation of subtlety, nuance, ambiguity. That goes out the window. And things become just almost childishly simplistic and clear, you know. And you might think to times when, you know, you were incredibly triggered or someone else was incredibly triggered, you know, and someone's incredibly triggered, they might be, you know, presenting these bizarre illogical dichotomies, you know, either you need to be this way or I can never talk to you again, you know, like that kind of thing. And then, of course, when we're calmed down, we realize, no, in fact, there are many possibilities. When we're more relaxed, when we're in parasympathetic arousal, then the truly relaxed, then the brain becomes more spacious. We can encompass more possibilities. We can see more perspectives. We have a much higher tolerance for ambiguity. We're sensitive to subtlety and nuance, and so it's very, very different. And so the attachment to being right is tricky, because even if our surface personality is relatively chill and relaxed and open-minded and all that, when we're triggered, we're more likely to go into the dogmatically, you know, must be right kind of place. Often when we're triggered, we're under the influence of some kind of infantile place that's been wounded. And of course, infants also don't have an incredible understanding of logic and subtlety, you know. Much in an infant's world is black and white. And there are certainly some people who struggle with this a great deal, who can't be wrong at all, who will go to incredible, you know, convolutions and you know, to avoid being wrong or avoid admitting having made a mistake, this sort of thing. And a lot of that behavior is actually driven by toxic shame. So toxic shame, it's a very common emotion. Probably all of us have it to some degree. It is an incredibly painful place. It is the place that says, you know, I am awful, I am horrible, I am the lowest being in creation, I have no right to be here, that sort of message. If I am in touch with, if I have a lot of toxic shame, you know, of course it's a very human thing to not want to feel it, to, you know, push it away. I'm not going to feel that, you know. But of course, if we're pushing it away, we're actually giving it power to drive our lives. And so out of that toxic shame comes all kinds of behaviors. For example, one-upping behavior or topping behavior, you know, haha, I did this better than you, that kind of behavior, which provides a very temporary relief, you know, in that moment that I top somebody else. It's as if the message to the shame is, okay, at this moment, I'm not the lowest being in creation because I just put somebody lower than me, like that sort of thing. And so it's sort of a temporary hit that's a release from shame. But of course, it adds to shame because some part of me registers, I was just not nice to that person, and then there's more shame about that. But a lot of the needing to be right and not wanting to admit the wrong, you know, if I'm trying to be right and then someone, you know, I'm clinging to that with all that power and then someone makes me wrong, it's like they're almost validating. They're throwing me down into that internal hell where I'm rejected, you know, that kind of thing. And we see this play out with dogmatic groups often. You know, it's very tricky. You know, certainly there are, you know, how should we say, conspiracy-driven groups, many of them on the extreme right in the United States, and many of those have these incredibly dogmatic views about, you know, this is what's going on. And part of that view is, you know, we're all right about this, and the people who don't get it, they're evil. They're, you know, and especially in the more the very conservative forms of Christianity, where it's, you know, we're the saved ones and everyone else is going to hell, you know, that kind of thing. And that worldview it's really an incredible outpicturing of the nature of a fragile psyche, a psyche where only this tiny range of experience is safe, and everything out of that tiny range of experience is toxic shame, is the hell of toxic shame. And so it's almost like the worldview that they're articulating is an outpicturing of the fragile state of their psyche. And so those are some examples on the political right, but on the political left, there are things like the cancel culture, which is also this incredible manifestation of toxic shame, you know, like, that's so wrong, we're gonna, you know, label that as evil and I never have to talk to that again, you know, that sort of thing. You know, there's, how can I say, sometimes among white people in anti-racist work, you know, the whole idea of, like, you know, the white person wanting to be the most white, woke white person, you know, the most knowledgeable and anti-racist, you know, and sometimes that person can be someone who's like a PC policeman calling out other people, you know. That person also might be the kind of white person who would go and, you know, explain to a person of color, you know, look how well I understand racism, you know, like, you know, in case you didn't know about it, you know, that sort of thing. You know, looking for validation from outside. And so it's very tricky. And how can I say, the people on the left are most offended by the displays of toxic shame on the right. And the people on the right are most offended by the displays of toxic shame on the left. And so it's quite a paradoxical situation here, that a lot of finger pointing and very few people talking about how we heal toxic shame. It's sometimes said that one of the great questions in life is, do you want to be right or happy? I remember at one point a psychology professor, he was talking about the character of Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost. And he was saying that Satan was this incredibly accurate, you know, the character that Milton created in this work was this incredibly accurate portrayal of someone who's neurotic. Because he didn't want to admit he was wrong. He was clinging to the fact, I know I'm right. I know I'm right. But because he was clinging to that, he was in hell. You know? And that's very much what neurosis is. You know, some part of us is locked in hell because we're clinging to that being right about something. And it's this paradoxical question, you know, do you want to be right or happy? You know, someone who's living in a very head-centered place might say, well, I'm happy when I'm right, you know, like that sort of thing. And of course, the being happy when you're right, that's a very shallow, head-centered kind of satisfaction. That's very different from the satisfaction of being fully in the body, fully alive, tasting life, being at peace with life. A much richer embodied experience. We live in a culture that tends to be very head-centered, very verbal-centered, very attached to our verbal formulations. And sometimes we forget that the deeper kinds of rightness, the deeper kinds of truth, are not the verbal formulations, but what we live out from the depths of our core. You know, I often like to say that the most powerful message I send in the world, it's not my words, it's the energetic signature, the powerful energetic signature that I carry as I walk through the world. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. I dropped the link in chat there. So we got this, a lead quote from Mr. Confucius. To put the world in order, we must first put the nation in order. To put the nation in order, we must put the family in order. To put the family in order, we must cultivate our personal life. To cultivate our personal life, we must first set our hearts right. So this whole idea of not looking outside, but always looking toward this inner self-responsibility. We also have a quote from Zhuangzi, the Taoist sage. He lived a couple centuries after Laozi. Zhuangzi said, right is not right, so is not so. If right were really right, it would differ so clearly from not right that there would be no need for argument. If so were really so, it would differ so clearly from not so that there would be no need for argument. Forget the years, forget distinction, leap into the boundless and make it your home. So we have representatives of both halves of ancient Chinese tradition there in Confucianism and in Taoism. Of course, the famous quote from Rumi, out beyond all ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. Thomas Carlyle said, a man cannot make a pair of shoes rightly unless he do it in a devout manner. And that whole idea that the energy with which we do something is actually what gives rightness to an action. Mark Twain said, the difference between a right word and an almost right word is a really large matter. It's the difference between a lightning bug and the lightning. You know, and something fascinating there about what is really right and what is almost right. You know, there's something very, very subtle there. Cézanne said, I do not want to be right in theory, but in nature. Oscar Wilde said, when people agree with me, I always feel I must be wrong. Theodore Roosevelt said, justice consists not in being neutral between right and wrong, but finding out the right and upholding it wherever found against the wrong. And so this paradox of, you know, it, in some sense, it's very important to know what is morally right and morally wrong and to fight for what is morally right. And we run into problems when we get attached even to what we think is morally right. You know, so there's something very subtle there. G.K. Chesterton said, to realize that the question does not matter is the first step toward answering it correctly. Jung said, we must be able to let things happen in the psyche. For us, this is actually an art of which very few people know anything. Consciousness is forever interfering, helping, correcting, negating, and never leaving the simple growth of the psychic processes in peace. It would be simple enough if only simplicity were not the most difficult of all things. The Zen master Kodo Suwaka said, the question isn't who's right, you're simply seeing things from different points of view. And relatedly, the Nobel physicist Niels Bohr said, the opposite of a correct statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound truth may well be another profound truth. Groucho Marx said quite simply, if you're not having fun, you're doing something wrong. Peter Marshall said, Lord, where we are wrong, make us willing to change. Where we are right, make us easy to live with. Something very humbling about that. Peter Drucker said, the most serious mistakes are not being made as a result of wrong answers. The truly dangerous thing is asking the wrong question. And it's actually incredibly important and very subtle. What are the questions we ask of life? And are we asking the right questions? Jack Kerouac said, one day we'll find the right words and they will be simple. The Zen master Song Song said, open your mouth and you're wrong. And he was primarily talking about Zen, you know, anything you can say about Zen, as soon as you start talking about it, you're wrong. But there's something wonderfully playful about that. And then Edward Abbey says in his mischievous way, there's a way of being wrong which is also sometimes necessarily right. Robert Persig, in his classic, said, so the thing to do when working on a motorcycle, as in all other tasks, is to cultivate peace of mind which does not separate oneself from one's surrounding. When that is done successfully, then everything else follows. Peace of mind produces right value. Right values produces right thoughts. Right thoughts produce right actions. And right actions produce work, which will be a material reflection for others to see of the serenity at the center of it all. Mark Nepo said, when we keep choosing between right and wrong, we spend our energy sorting life rather than living it. Sharon Salzberg said, sometimes kindness takes the form of stepping aside, letting go of our need to be right, and just being happy for someone else. The wise man Malcolm Gladwell says, the older I get, the more that I understand is that the only way to say valuable things is to lose your fear of being correct. I think he also said something like, you know, make hundreds of predictions. Some of them will be true, and those are the ones you'll be remembered for, you know. Chantram Rinpoche says, your path may be different from that of your family, friends, and country, but despite what they may think, it doesn't mean that you're going in the wrong direction. Multi Bojangwi says, the sooner you decide that it is all right to believe the opposite of what the masses do, that it is all right to trust the universe, and you choose to be happy rather than right, the sooner you will be happy. Albert Bernstein said, life offers a cruel choice. You can be right or happy, not both. This is regardless of whom you may be involved with. And Abhijit Nasker says quite simply, being caring is more important than being right.